Hi, it's Lucy, and welcome back to another episode of The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I shine a spotlight on the talented women working in cinema. Today, I'm joined by the brilliant Ella Dorman-Gaich, a writer, performer, and filmmaker whose work spans film, theatre, poetry, and spoken word. We're here to talk about her brand new short film, Back of the Net, a moving intergenerational story that arrives at the perfect time, just as excitement is building around the Women's Euros in July. The film follows Maya, a gifted young footballer on the brink of going pro, who's torn between her future and caring for her nan Maggie, a former player now living with dementia. It's a heartfelt look at ambition, sacrifice, and the powerful connection between generations of women, both on and off the pitch. We'll be talking about the inspiration behind the film, women's football on screen, and why stories like Back of the Net are so important right now. Thanks for listening, and I hope you love today's conversation. So yeah, let's just get started. I love to ask my podcast guests, you know, about their beginnings in the film world. And I'm curious particularly about, you know, your upbringing and your sort of Serbian-Austrian heritage. And I'm wondering what drew you to performance and storytelling in the first place, you know, was it from a young age? And at what point did you start gaining interest in this area?
Yes, I think I've always had a natural inclination from a young age to tell stories. I do think all humans are natural storytellers, but I was a lot more sort of brash about it. Even from a young age, I used to dress up myself and my sister and get like little theatres in. I used to make our living room into a theatre and put on plays. And then, I mean, I think a lot of people working in film and theatre say it's like, oh, I was born for the stage kind of thing. But I guess I never really let that go. And I was involved in community theatre from being a teenager. I think the first play I properly acted in was Midsummer Night's Dream. I was Helena. That was my big breakthrough for Lewis Community Theatre. And then, yeah, I did lots of different plays with local theatre mm-hmm. companies. So my background is very strong in theatre. That's where I've developed the storytelling muscle. And yeah, more recently transitioned into film, but I'm a big film fan. And it's always been a dream of mine. So Back of the Net is my debut as a writer, but I've also acted in several other short films as well. Mm-hmm. And I really love the short film format. I think it's a great way to cut your teeth in film, but also I just love like bite-sized short films. I think they're such a great way of conveying short, sharp stories, especially about the modern world.
I mean, before moving into, you know, this sort of first step into filmmaking, as you were saying, you know, you've done quite a lot of theatre, community theatre, and then as well as poetry and spoken word. So I'm wondering, you know, how these sort of skills that you learned and gained in this has sort of transferred to what you do now. You know, how did you get sort of started in those spaces, you know, doing spoken word and poetry especially, as well as theatre?
So I started being involved in the poetry open mic scene in Brighton, actually, when I was about, yeah, like 19, my gap year sort of excursion. But I'd always written like little angsty poems in my room before going to sleep. And I felt like writing poetry through verse was a very personal thing for me, very cathartic. And it still is my most personal form of writing. And I love how spoken word, especially, I was able to combine my background in theatre with writing and poetry. The thing I loved most about getting up on stage and delivering a poem was the immediacy of it, which you don't necessarily have with theatre, in that you can write a poem that day, you can write a poem the night before, and next day you can get up and perform it in front of 100 people. Mm. Being exposed to that, and there was a real bustling spoken word scene in Brighton at the time and still is. So that really inspired me, that just immediacy of it and ability to express things that I saw about the world and express my understanding of the world as a young woman coming of age, which obviously is a very pivotal time for a lot of people. And I think writing can be a great outlet for that. So yeah, I really... The first thing I wrote and performed of my own writing was poetry. And then it, from there, I wanted to build in more narrative. And I've done a lot of combination between poetry and narrative. And yeah, I do still do a lot of poetry, is my first love. And I think poetry is really there for people. And I think poetry is a great way of inciting community. I run a poetry night now. But even from back in those early years when I was first getting into poetry, I made a lot of amazing friends. So I think it's a great way of forming community, which I really love about poetry. With film, you've got other things going on, like the cinematography. With poetry, it's just the writing, just bare bones, and it can be exposing. But I think because of that, it brings people close together. You feel like you know someone after hearing their poem just that little bit better. And I think because of that, great communities are formed in the poetry world.
I mean, it's very interesting that you say about the whole sort of immediacy of it. Because, of course, like whether that's theatre or film, there's, I mean, as you'll know now after having made, Back of the Net, it involves a lot more prep and editing and adjusting and changes. Whereas, as you say, with poetry or spoken word, it's kind of you write it the night before and then you perform it the next day. So there's, it's quite, yeah, it's very a quick turnover, really, of production to performance, I guess. But also, it's a great place for you to gain confidence as well with your writing and your voice in front of a crowd as well, that's immediate as well. So I find that very interesting. Whereas maybe the response for a film is a bit more delayed, like you might not know what people have thought, or they might not share in the same way until maybe you read reviews or something.
Exactly. I completely agree. And I think the more you share your work with an audience, the better. I'm a big believer of that because you're exposed to the light and the shade audiences think of your work. They're not always going to love it necessarily, but to be able to build resilience towards that and a thick skin and carry on regardless is something that you should develop if you want to have longevity as an artist, I believe.
I mean, I can already think of two women in the sort of, I guess, more TV world than film, but like Michaela Cole or Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Fleabag, I think, started out as a play before it became TV, and Michaela Cole's TV show Chewing Gum was spoken word play, I think, beforehand. So it's, yeah, definitely an interesting way to test the waters with your creative voice and see how the audience reacts. Can you tell me about one of your earliest works that made you think, this is really what I want to do? Like, I just feel so in the right place, really, like in terms of what you wanted to do with your career.
Great question. Oh, I've got two answers for that, actually. I wrote
Can give me all your answers.
all the answers. You can just take whatever you want. So I wrote a spoken word hybrid theatre show for Brighton Fringe when I was 19, and it was massively, wildly ambitious. I didn't know who I thought I was, to be honest. Wish still had some of that. Yeah, that energy about me. I still do a little bit, but like I think I was just very confident that I wanted to put on a show for Brighton Fringe, and I pitched it to a funding company and they gave me some money, and it I'd not even written it yet, and then I suddenly was like, I had to actually read this thing. So, yeah, I had I think I had that sort of brazenness from quite a young age. When I put my mind to something, I follow it through. So this was a it was called Did I Choose These Shoes? And it was about coming of age as a woman. And it I kind of describe it as more like a concept album of lots of different poems, but all encapsulates teenagehood and specifically female teenagehood and the biases that women, that girls specifically face, and the more insidious types of sexism, which sound like very broad themes and very tricky, murky, complex themes for a 19-year-old to be
Yeah,
tackling.
very, very bold from a young
Oh
age.
yeah, but I did that, and I was really proud of myself for the time. At the time, I mean, I look back and I think, what was I thinking for some of it? Because I've learned so much more now, and know so much more now. But I honor it as a piece of work that I would never perform again, of course. But I honor it as a piece of work that I performed at that time, and I actually think even though some of the writing maybe wasn't my greatest. It was 19, I forgive myself. And I also managed to incorporate my experience from the stage into poetic form. So I sort of very much sort of blended the two, blendery with theatre. And I think I managed to do that reasonably successfully from feedback, and we did get good reviews, which was nice. So being able to incorporate craft and make poetry a little bit theatrical, make it theatrical in its storytelling. And I think that's something that isn't done too often, and I wanted to achieve. So I did that. And then my first script, which was, had some poetry in it as well, actually. I was very much transitioning from poetry into theatre, writing for theatre at this point. So, but my first script that was performed in front of an audience was a play that was inspired by my relationship with my sister, my relationship with my grandma, which are themes that come up in my work, actually. It was performed in front of an audience, pub theatre in Islington called The Old Red Lion. And that was the first time, yeah, I'd seen other people perform my work and it being a log. And that was really rewarding. And I learned so much about dramaturgy and playwriting through that. And then I've done a few short plays since then. And then I went on to doing form plays.
So did you always know that you'd move into film? I mean, you mentioned that a bit earlier, but was it sort of a natural progression then from these other storytelling forms that you've done? Did it feel like the next step to take something you wanted to film, to document, to put on camera and on a screen ultimately, that felt different to, yeah, being on a stage?
Yes, I did always know I wanted to transition into film, even though I love theatre. I love experiencing live work in a space with audience. But I think the thing that appeals cinema is its reach. I mean, it just has such a wildly expansive reach. And I think, I truly believe that storytelling has the power to change lives. I know this seems like a very
groundbreaking,
but I do truly believe it. Like, there are films and plays that have really shifted my perspective on the world. And I think giving a platform for people's stories that are more undertold is particularly what I'm interested in. And I think to fulfill that belief, strong belief and interest, it just has to be able to reach a wider audience. And I think, even though I love theatre, the frustration I was getting, especially with the theatre I was making, was, I guess, I did a tour of a play and it, you know, we managed to reach quite a broad audience, but and we got some good numbers and some sellout shows, which I'm really proud of for my play trade. But, you know, after it was like, oh, I want it to have that further reach. I want it to be documented a bit more. Filming of plays still isn't something that's too readily available, although we did film an earlier draft of it, which I'm proud of. And I think now we have so much amazing technology to be able to tell stories with. And film is our widest reaching story medium. And there are certain things about film that I find just so magical as well. I mean, I loved working with our director, Clara, and she's got such an amazing visual eye for storytelling. And I learned so much from her. And I think humans are naturally very visual beings. So I think that's why we're so drawn to film. And I think I'm really excited by what can be told visually, which I think opens up a new muscle for me and in my storytelling skill.
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything you were saying there. You know, the way that film and just capturing something on camera and documenting it, I mean, it's definitely got more longevity as well in terms of, you know, as opposed to a play, which is kind of a bit more ephemeral. You might not be able to revisit it in the same way that you can a film, or you know, watch it 10 years later, and unless it's been filmed, as you say. But that's, you know, not so common in theatre. So yeah, and you know, I agree as well that it's got such a wide reach. And even though film can be seen as something maybe a bit materialistic, I don't know, sometimes, or glamorous, or that kind of side of things, but I mean, when you think of big, you know, big international film festivals and how that reaches so many people, And there's stories that you wouldn't see otherwise or know about otherwise, you know, things going on in the world or different people's experiences if it weren't for, you know, certain films that were made. So for now, I'd love to talk about Back of the Net, of course. I mean, you were just talking there about your work sort of often revisiting like your relationship with your sister and your grandmother. I mean, for those that don't know or haven't seen Back of the Net yet, like I have, can you tell me about the inspiration behind it and what sparked the idea for the film?
Yeah, so I've written a lot about my relationship with my grandma. Plot twist, my grandma in real life was not a footballer. So, your back of the net, for those who don't know, it's about a young, aspiring footballer who's torn between her final shot at going professional and caring for her grandmother, who was once a former lioness. And we learn that it was actually her, the grandmother, Maggie, who inspired Maya, the main character's pursuit of this dream. So, that conflict between past and present, that is really pivotal to the film itself. So mainly within football, but I think it can be applicable to so many things. I mean, football is a heavily gendered sport, and it's only really in the last 5 years that it's come to public focus in England, and people have really got behind the Lionesses, which is incredible. In terms of my inspiration behind it, I mean, it was literally watching us win the Euros, watching England win the Euros.
Yeah, they finally brought it
We
home.
finally brought it home. We did. And the euphoria that just charged through my body. I mean, I was in this packed club. Good in a club, though. God, party going on at
As
Long. Should
well.
have gone to the club. But yeah, I was in this crowded pub, and I had, England flag on, and we just won, and we were celebrating outside. And then this man walks past, and he was like, "Hey, why have you got England flags on?" And I was like, "Because we just won the Euros." And I don't know what rock you've been living under. And he was like, "No, we didn't." And I was like, "Yes, we did." And I was like, "We literally did." And I showed him the screen. He was like, "Oh, that's just in though." And
I know it's in comparison, people don't value it or count it almost as if it's real sport, which is crazy.
I mean, Alicia Russo back kicked that ball into the goal. I've not seen a male footballer do that ever. So in a big international tournament. So yeah, I mean, I think they're just incredible, inspiring players, inspiring women, and that's what spurred me to do it. I mean, I had already written a lot, kind of the caring aspect, caring for an older relative, and that's appeared in other parts of my work, but that's what kind of spurred me on to doing it about football players. So, former football married with current aspiring football player, matching somebody's disintegration with somebody's emancipation. And you learn in the film that Maggie's got early Alzheimer's. So, she's forgetting that part of her life, forgetting influence that she had on Maya. So it's kind of all of those complex themes married together, and it's all just a snapshot of this one, like a final 2 weeks building up to her big match and the obstacles that get in Maya's way. So yeah, it's very much inspired by, also like taken from my own experiences coming of age and trying to balance family with your own aspirations in your own life beyond that. And I just think it's really also really inspired by, I was really interested by the former lionesses who never received their caps up until very recently after 2022 lionesses won, and just how historically the lionesses have been so erased from history and brushed under the carpet at every turn. And really wanted to help give a platform to the lionesses who played for England in the past. I mean, the FA banned women's football from 1981 to 1971. They put out a
Okay,
statement.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I did a lot of research after winning the Euros. I was so fascinated by the history of women's football, and it's not a new thing. We've been playing football.
Been around a while.
Yeah, we've been playing football since the 1800s. We were playing football, women were playing football, and the men were away at war. And then when they came back, they were like, we don't like these women playing football. What are they doing? Get off the field. They put out a statement saying that football is a sport wholly unsuitable for females. And they were just perpetuating all of these myths about it being bad for the female body and bad for ovaries. So, you know, 50 years it was banned. So we're really 50 years behind in terms of its development and everything. Women were playing, you know, in amateur leagues and stuff like that, but they couldn't play professionally. So a lot of it has been erased or brushed under the carpet up until very recent years. And then once I'd written this, I sent it to this football historian who I'd read a lot of her work, called Jean Williams, and read the script within like 20 minutes and emailed me. She was like, I want to be involved. How can I get involved?
Amazing.
And we jumped on a Zoom and she was like, do you want to come to St. George's Park? So I came to St. George's Park, which is the Lionesses train. And I saw them at their final training day just before going off to play in New Zealand for the World Cup.
That's such an amazing experience, and also just like a great place to go for research and really getting in the mindset for the film.
Exactly, that was exactly it. And I used that for final bits of research, and I managed to talk to some of them, got a little cheeky with Jill Scott. I just had to when in Rome, you know.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, it's definitely put, since day one, definitely put more of a spotlight on them, I think, you know, that there wasn't before. And I mean, you've taught me so much, just tell me about what you've learned yourself there. I mean, I wasn't aware that it was banned. I wasn't aware of, you know, the different reasons why we weren't allowed to play. I mean, that's really, it's crazy. But at the same time, I'm not surprised at certain things anymore, but, you know, it still is obviously shocking, and it's a shame that it was like that. But it's great that things are changing, and it's such a great way to motivate you. Like, I'm really inspired by how you're motivated to make the film, you know, just from that game and from them winning. It spurred you on to, you know, make your own story about it, which is amazing. As you were saying, there's sort of also like quite a powerful emotional undercurrent about Alzheimer's, and I'm wondering, was that based, you know, if you don't mind me asking, was that based on personal experience, or was that something that you also had to research quite deeply about for the film?
I did research it as well, but it is partly inspired by personal experience. My grandfather had Alzheimer's. I was too young to care for him at the time. My grandfather actually was Serbian. He forgot all of his English by the end, so I actually only spoke Serbian to him or heard him speak, which is interesting the way that Alzheimer's affects the brain. And my mum and my auntie cared for him, and I witnessed that. And then my grandmother got sick, not with Alzheimer's, actually with cancer, and I cared for her. I helped to care for her. But yeah, so my experience of Alzheimer's comes from my grandfather, and speaking to my mum specifically about her experience, talking to him when he was, I mean, what I explore in the film is these moments that happen that are very memorable, these shifts when you realize that, oh, that person doesn't recognize you anymore. So yeah, and I really do want to develop Back of the Net into a longer form thing, and I think it's something that I would want to explore in more depth in a longer form. But I've spoken to a few people who have watched the film who have got experience, relatives with Alzheimer's, who have been complimentary of the way it's portrayed, which I'm very thankful of, because that was a big fear of mine, was not authentic portraying it. But yeah, it's a really important part of the story.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, from very early on in the film, you know, I'm really rooting for the main character, you know, for her to be seen by the scout at the game and to not let the other things get in the way. But I can also see that tension between, you know, her youth, like her future, but also her grandma's aging, but then also she wants her freedom, but she knows she has a responsibility. So it's interesting that you explored that kind of difficult push and pull, like of wanting to pursue your dreams, but to honor your family and help them and look after them. It's not an easy balance to get, especially when there's other members in the family, like in this film, you know, that either aren't helping or they've got their own lives to get on with as well. You know, it's a juggle for sure. It just shows that sometimes when you're wanting to achieve your dreams, it's not very straightforward, you know, like, you know, especially when you've got family dynamics in the middle of it as well. I mean, as well as writing the film, you perform in it as well as the lead character. So I'm wondering how you approach writing the characters, and especially the protagonists. I mean, yeah, did you like base it quite a lot on yourself or just more experiences? Yeah, I'm wondering, yeah, how closely you based it on your own experiences, or would you kind of separate yourself from that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, there are strong elements of myself in Maya, the main character. And I do think with the majority of protagonists I've written, there is an element of myself in them, but there are differences. There are key differences. I mean, yeah, I'm sorry to let you down, but I'm not actually a footballer.
It's okay. I didn't expect you to become a pro footballer for the film.
Yeah, sorry to let your listeners down. I was there in my local park trying to train every single day. God, football is so hard.
Oh, it is.
But yeah, I did sort of write it. When I was writing it, I ended up just writing it as me. I was like, oh God, this is very me. And it also inspired by, like, you know, relationships in my life as well. And then so it came to it, just sort of like made sense. I mean, I do have been playing football for the Deptford Ravens. Shout out Deptford Ravens. And also shout out Bend It Like Peckham, inspired by the small film you might have heard of called Bend It Like Beckham.
Of course. I hadn't mentioned it yet, but I did want to eventually.
Such a great name. But yeah, I was playing football for, like, locally, grassroots. And that's also what the film tackles as well, is the rise in grassroots women's teams. So, you know, I thought, yeah, I could do this. And I think the magic of film is that you can pull that off. But yeah, I think I really had such a great time acting in it. Maureen Casey, who plays my grandmother in the film, Maya's grandma, we just had an immediate chemistry. It really worked very well between us. So yeah.
Did you find it challenging at all to switch, you know, from the writer's mindset to the actor's mindset? How did you sort of manage that dual role? I guess you weren't directing, or because, you know, you didn't direct it, but I guess you were on set potentially there as well, to, you know, as you were acting, to maybe add in any changes or things that you maybe might have said differently or improvised and changed from the script.
It was okay. I did feel anxiety about it, though. I think it is a very difficult thing to do. I think I thought easier than it was. Having said that, I'd acted in a few theatre things that I'd written in the past, so it's not something I wasn't used to doing, but it's different for the screen, I think. And, you know, the director has a lot more of a hold over things on set, obviously, and so they should. And Clara's an incredible director. I don't think there were any big parts where I changed a line or anything on set. I think because we'd gone through such an extensive development process, like, I'd been writing it for a year. They wanted to get it right. So I'd sat with the script a lot before we got. I think if I hadn't sat with the script and it had not gone through like three drafts, I might have been in a situation where I was trying to edit on set. But because I knew I was writing it, I wanted to get the script, like, down, like, in its minutiae. Obviously, you know, they can't be helped. There is some ad-libbing on set. Like, I learned that through Back of the Net. Like, there are some things that get in there, just have actors say in the moment, make the final cut. And that's absolutely fine as well. Like, I'm not too precious about that. For the most part, it was, I would say that what ended up the film was pretty accurate to what was in the script. Obviously, like, naturally there's going to be some difference of opinion on set, and then you sort of deal with that. But I'm so thrilled with the people we worked with. Clara, I sing her praises all the time. She's such an incredible director, amazing collaborator. And yeah, everybody was just so amazing set. Like, I really feel gifted to have worked with that group of people, because they really cared about the project, which I think can be a rare thing.
Yeah, I mean, also, I think that the visual language and the tone of the film are really distinctive. And I just thought also the cinematography was really beautiful. Can you tell me a bit about the, you know, the aesthetic choices and influences? Was that something you had an input on, or was it mostly the director making those choices? Yeah, how did you sort of decide on how it was going to look, and maybe how certain editing was going to be done, like the different cuts, for example? I guess that was maybe something that you included in the script or left up to the director.
Yeah, some of them I was a bit more perceptive on in the script, and some of them came out in the edit. But yeah, for example, towards the end of the film, there's a cut between the grandma's home and the pitch. And that was actually in the script, that montage. But then some of the montages sort of changed and developed in the edit. And I think that's a very natural thing to happen sometimes, because, I mean, it's that classic thing a lot of people say, like, you make three times, like, when you write it, when you shoot it, and then when you edit it. And then I would argue also, then when you show it
yeah.
for the first So in terms of aesthetic choices, I mean, in terms of like color grades and the blocking and the shots, that was all Clara. I'm not going to take any credit for that. But yeah, she has a very specific eye for things, especially in terms of color. She's incredible when it comes to color. And you probably will notice that it has the pastel tones to it. It feels very kind of soft, and I really liked the fact that she married that up with something that is typically quite like gritty and aggressive, like football. She married it with more softer tones, and I think it's just a bit more unexpected.
So were there any other films? I mean, of course, you were inspired by The Lionesses winning the cup at the time, but did you watch any films that were inspiring you while you were writing? I mean, probably Bend It Like Beckham. I mean, a bit of a cliche, but maybe you did watch that.
Yes, so I rewatched Bend It Like Beckham. What a great film. I actually love that film so much.
I haven't seen it in so long, but I would like to revisit it. I loved it when I was younger. I definitely like sort of girl power type film that just sort of makes you feel really empowered.
I think so. It is interesting though with Bend It Like Beckham, because it was such a popular film in the noughties, and it was so widely, and it was obviously the first film about women in football, really, I know of, to have reached that wider audience. But the fact it didn't have like an impact on the ground in terms of like the wide distribution and awareness of the Lionesses didn't come until 20 years after Bend It Like Beckham was made is quite interesting. There didn't seem to be that sort of, in the strategy, that marrying up of the film being released and also like promoting women's football in the real world, what I mean, for whatever reason. I think it did have some impact, but yeah, it's funny that it's taken this long for the Lionesses to reach the audience that they are reaching now, the massive audience that they are reaching now. But sorry, that doesn't answer your question at all. Your question was influences. Oh, you know, a film that was a massive influence for me was the film Coda. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh, yes, I've seen it. The sign language film of the girl that goes to wants. Yeah, actually, now that you say that, the character is quite similar in terms of wanting to help her parents with their fishing village, but she wants to go off to be at a singing school, if I remember right. But I have seen it, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, what a beautiful film. Mm-hmm. That one had me absolutely bawling my eyes out in the cinema. I was sobbing.
Yeah, it's a lovely film.
I was blubbering like a fish. Yeah, beautiful film, but so funny at points as well. And the tension in that film is similar. She's torn between her parents and also her dream of becoming a musician. And the conflict obviously being that her parents can't hear. So there's that massive disconnect between them. And yeah, that was just such a beautiful, beautiful film. That actually won the Oscar there. And it's
it did, yeah.
Yeah, it was quite an independently made. I think obviously it had a lot of funding, but as far as I know, it was quite independent. And it was actually a remake of a French film.
Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah. It's what was it called in French? But they actually have it with a French singer called Louane, I believe. She played the role of the girl wanting to go off to be a musician. But yeah, it came out in France first. But the Americans always like to, when they find a story they like, they want to snatch it up. But I do think they adapted it very, very well. And I haven't seen the French version, but yeah, it was interesting that was an inspiration, because I definitely see a connection between your film and that one for sure.
Yeah, it's a great, great film. I love that. It's one of my favorites.
And were there any others, or would you say that was probably the main one then?
Oh, in terms of the writing, coming of age stories, a film that was the inspiration for me was the film Eighth Grade, which is actually by Bo Burnham. It's an A24 film. The themes don't show up so much in the back of the net, but that film really struck a chord with me and understanding what I want to write out. And that pivotal time, I mean, the character in Back of the Net is a bit older, but I think teenage years are such a pivotal time and such a complex time to explore through, because you're dealing with so much and you're going through the hormones and you're deciding what to do with the rest of your life and trying to fit in and assimilate as well. So that film has been a big inspiration for not just Back of the Net, but my writing in general. And I really resonated with it as well, feeling like an odd one out, feeling like you don't don't fit in. So that film, I absolutely love that film. Yeah, there probably are loads of inspirations. I think I subliminally absorb a lot of things that I watch. Oh yes, this is an inspiration. In My Skin. I don't know if you know the TV In My Skin.
No,
I recommend it to so many people. Oh, you've got to watch it, Lucy.
I will.
It's a Welsh TV show on BBC, and it's beautiful, but it's sad at points. And it's about a girl who, a single, an only child who is caring for her mother who's got bipolar. She lies about it, all of her friends and everyone at school, and it's about her reckoning with that. And I love the writing. I think the writing is spectacular. And the relationships are so real, and it's so hard, and she's an imperfect character. She's, you know, she lies, she's a bit of a bitch, like she's complex, she's knotty, but you still love her. And she's an aspiring poet, actually. She expresses herself through poetry. So yeah, it's got similar themes of teenagehood, trying to discover yourself, but also caring for a family member. That, oh God, I cried so much. I can't hold it together. I think I've got a problem. I cry a lot about things I watch. I get very emotionally invested.
I'm the same. I if it's a if the film gets me, or a TV show, then I can very much, yeah, be in tears about it as well. I think the last film that I properly cried about was After Sun. Like, I haven't properly cried after another film since that one, really, for me.
I didn't cry at that one, but that one did pull at the strings for sure.
Mm. Your film also makes me think about a little bit about, like, Lady Bird as well. I mean, maybe not in the same sense of, like, a rebellious or, like, rude or naughty sort of character in the same way Lady Bird does a little bit, but in the same way that, you know, she's sort of got that push and pull between wanting to leave home and, but, you know, stay. Yeah, it's like that kind of, as you say, coming of age time when they're going through all these hormones and experiences and not knowing what to do next. It's like I love a coming of age film. Like, it's one of my favorite genres. I'm wondering if, do you see yourself continuing to create roles for yourself in your future films, or would you want to sort of write and stay behind the camera or direct? Or yeah, have you thought about what you'd like to do next?
Yeah, great question. I think I've got lots and lots of aspirations. Sometimes my eyes are bigger than my belly, and I need to rein it in. But I do want to build towards directing, especially with a short film that I've written. I've been toying for so long about whether to direct it myself, in all honesty, to be candid. But I really want to take the leap and do it.
Do it.
Thank you. I believe I can do it. It is a scary thing, though. Like, having seen and been on set a lot and how directors work, I do feel like I have an understanding of how much you need to and how completely tunnel vision committed you need to be to a project and seeing it through from end. And
you've got a lot of decisions to make and a lot of people needing you at the same time, you know, like needing your attention and your answer, your approval. Or
exactly, that's the thing. You need to be really good at making decisions and really good at knowing every different part of production, which I'm learning. Like, I do feel like I have such a more nuanced understanding of all the different parts of a crew than I did, you know, to go before I made Back of the Net. I mean, it's such an eye-opener. I do actually really strongly believe that making a film is the best school you could go to, just learning through doing. And you will make mistakes.
Absolutely.
Inevitably, yeah. Make mistakes, but, you know, you'll learn from those and make sure to keep a record of your mistakes and remind yourself of, you know, learning things that you learn and
what not to do again.
Exactly.
How have audiences responded so far to Back of the Net, and how do you hope audience will respond, you know, for those that haven't seen it?
Yeah, so we're still on the film festival circuit. We've actually been screened at 20 now, which is amazing.
Screening, you've done 20 screenings?
Sorry, say that again?
You've done about 20 screenings, is that what you said?
Yeah, I think just over 20 screenings.
Amazing.
Now. So it's reached quite a wide audience, and yeah, it's incredible the response it's had. A lot of people have been so, so complimentary about it, and people, I mean, I always, because I've obviously seen it about a million times now, I just watch the audience watching it. And it's interesting to see what audiences laugh at different points, and, you know, now it's screened in France, actually.
Oh, wow.
one. And, you know, I think the French audiences responded really well with it. It was actually screened to 20,000 school children. Ooh. So it was screened as part of an additional programme which was attached to the film festival This Is England.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well done. 20,000 people, that's not intimidating at all.
I know. I didn't even realise until after it had been screened. They were like, oh yeah, and by the way, we just like showed it to like 20,000 kids, no big deal.
Oh my
we were
God.
Like, well, what?
Although I feel like kids are like kind of the best audience because they're just like not as intimidating as adults, but they're also just very filter-free. Like they'll say it like it is, I think, which is...
They're real. Yeah. Just also on that point about young people resonating with the film, we won the Youth Jury Prize at Women X Festival,
wow.
Which was a real achievement because obviously a lot of the time these awards, it can be really murky and difficult to know like, oh, what made that film better than that film? And judging a film against like a metric, I mean, I don't necessarily like that at all because I don't think you can rate art, but I think what winning the Youth Jury Prize did show for us that it is resonating with young people on a, you know, a demographic, a consensus of people voting. So it is nice to hear that it's resonating with younger people because it is a story about somebody finding themselves, and I hope that that can help other people as well, especially coming of age.
I was actually thinking though that showing it to, you know, audiences and showing it in big screenings, it's almost like, you know, when you show your a friend or a family member one of your favorite films and you want to see how they react to it, and you're just sort of like looking over at them and they're like, are they enjoying it? I hope they like it, kind of thing. But it's that on a big scale.
Yeah, it is that. Oh my God, it is. And it's scary. But I think having seen it in cinemas so many times now has helped me build a resilience for showing my work. Mm. I don't know, maybe I'll be just as nervous with the next film. Who knows? But I was so nervous the first time we showed Back of the Big Screen. But now it's just like, just another weekend.
Yeah, exactly. I would say that the film definitely left me feeling hopeful. You know, it ended on a good note, really. And I'm wondering what sort of informed your decision of ending it this way on an optimistic note. I mean, maybe that's quite an obvious answer to give, like you wanted to be a happy ending simply and not a sad one. But yeah, I mean, you could have approached it in another way, but I guess, you know, what was your decision on how you wanted to leave it and end it with people?
Yeah, Jen, I think a lot about endings. I've been thinking a lot about endings recently in my writing because I think what you leave an audience with will actually be the deciding factor of what they ultimately think of the film. And I've been gravitating a lot more towards happy endings recently. My play that went on tour, Trade, didn't have so much of a happy ending. And it's not that I regret think the ending was appropriate for the story, but I've been more focused on this idea of hope in spite of all the adversity we see in our lives and in the world. I think if we lose hope, then what else do we have? And to cling on to the things that do make us happy and do bring joy, because the world is a scary place. Mm. And I think even obviously it's about tough themes, and Maya's going through a really thing of her, somebody so close to her having Alzheimer's, and I think leaving it with that strong relationship that they have but also a hope for Maya's future as well is what I wanted to. I didn't want to leave it with any like frustrations between Maggie. You know, there is still that part of Maggie that will always be football as well, and you know, Alzheimer's is such a complex thing. It's a really complex thing to capture in film as well, because obviously if you haven't experienced it firsthand, then it's really difficult to write about it and do it justice. So I'm writing about from the outside looking in and wanting to leave it in a note that, you know, shows that they still care about each other and there is still love there, and to, you know, care for the memories that person, Maggie, created when she was younger as well, that still live within her today. But I, to answer your question in terms of choosing to go with a happy happier, more bonding. I guess that's a reflection of like where I am in my life at the moment. I'm more very much leaning into the hope is what will help us and get us through. Even if like, you know, I think some stories do, you know, need a more sort of, I think sometimes some story, not back of the net, but other stories need maybe a bit of more of a pessimistic ending or kick people into gear to be like, don't do this, that this will happen. But I don't think that Back of the Net was one of those stories. I think it was a story that needed a hopeful ending, or a bit ambiguous, but it still had hope there.
I'm wondering, in your personal life, do you have any creative rituals or habits that you do, you know, outside of poetry and writing, that you do to get into the right mindset for writing and performing?
Yeah, I do. As of the last year, I've been really big on my morning routine.
Love that. God, I need to get a morning routine.
It's so hard to do. Oh, well, it's taken many years to integrate this one. Let me tell you, I am not a morning person. I do feel a little bit like, oh, like holistic hippie, da da da. Like,
I mean, if you can, is maybe you don't have to do it every day, like, but I think if you can like get the majority of your week with a routine, then it's good. But I think, you know, you don't always have to expect it from yourself every day.
Oh, absolutely. I do agree, like, people are very, very hard on themselves if they don't, they miss it or something like that. Like, I miss my morning routine all the time, but I forgive myself. I get up and I do it again. You know, there's always tomorrow. But I mean, I'm very lucky at the moment. I work from home most days a week, either writing or teaching. So I am afforded that luxury. Obviously, that's a privilege, so I don't have to travel anywhere. I get people who have to travel. When I traveled to work, I was not doing my 20 minutes Pilates in the morning. Trust me, I was not.
More like running out the door kind of
thing.
Yeah,
I was actually running out the door, piece of toast in one hand, hair brother. That was me for 9 to 5. But yeah, I think like because I know my flow a little bit better now, it takes me longer to grind into gear in the morning. So I like to like journal. I am quite a big believer of the morning pages.
I've tried that before as well.
Yeah, it's from The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, which I've read most of. A lot of people treat it like a Bible. I treat it like a Bible, but the big takeaway I did get from it was the morning pages. So just like literally offloading anything that's in your mind onto the page first thing in the morning, before you're looking at your emails, before you're checking Instagram. And it just means that you're being a bit more intentional about and about your life in general and what you want to do, what your goals are for the day, how you're feeling. And I think it's really helped me get more aligned with myself personally, but also with myself as a writer and what I really want to focus on.
Yeah, I did the morning pages as well for about a good year or so, and I definitely saw benefits from it. Like, as you say, just getting all like that gunk out of your head in the morning and feeling like you're kind of starting on a clean slate in a way.
Absolutely. I really recommend if you manage to get time to go back and do it. But I also appreciate like whenever I have to be like at a job in the morning, like, yeah, I'm choosing that extra 10 minutes of sleep.
Yeah. Same. You do have to choose, don't you? It's like, okay, this morning, is it going to be breakfast that has to be forgotten? Or is it going to be, like you say, the morning pages, like something's got to give. Sometimes you can't do everything, but yeah.
Absolutely. So I think like, you know, if you manage to get time in the morning and you can do it, then yeah, do it. But I do think just journaling as a practice anyway, no matter what time in the day, if you have time later in the day, or even just doing it once a week, it has massive benefits. It helps you understand yourself so much better. And tracking your life a little bit, I think, get so caught up in this modern internet world that everything sort of blurs into one and the day sort of lead into the next. And I think journaling just punctuates my life so much more. So yeah, that's a little thing I do. I like to sort of move as well in the morning. I like to do some sort of exercise in the morning. And running as well is actually a big part of my creative process too. Like if I'm really struggling with a script or something, I'll just like go for a run, listen to like instrumental music and just think about a problem I'm having, or just let thoughts percolate in my mind. And then sometimes things will just solve themselves when I'm on the run. And I'm a real believer of just runner's high. Like I think it really helps my mental health.
Oh yeah, definitely. Any kind of exercise high or whatever from just sort of some movement is definitely beneficial. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm a big believer of that. And what do I do? I should probably, I mean, yeah, I should probably do some more stuff just for like, just for the fun of it, you know? But I am a big fan of summer.
Yeah, just
Big
the season,
fan of,
summer.
yeah, fan of going to the pub in summer with a pint
Yeah.
in my hand. That's my, yeah. So I find it more difficult to write in the summer because I get distracted by that prospect.
Oh no, I get that. I mean, I'm like, I'm definitely, even just not watching films and stuff, like I'm not doing so much because I'm outdoors more, which is obviously good. Like that's what you're supposed to do. The weather's better. And obviously you living in Brighton, like you've got the beach and everything. And yeah, I bet there's always so many lovely things going on during the summer as well in terms of events and whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So much going on. And, you know, we don't always get it. We don't always get the nice summertime. It can be a bit hit and miss. But yeah, it's, I definitely write more in the winter, which I'm not cross about. I like there being the seasons. I like that rise and fall of the year.
I was wondering what other filmmakers or artists have most influenced your work, directors or female filmmakers or, you know, male filmmakers as well. I mean, yeah, have you got any sort of key ones that have really made an impression on you?
Yeah, my favorite film is Past Lives. I just think it's such a beautiful piece of work by the writer director Celine Song, and it's really inspired the next piece I'm writing at the moment. I just think the way that it really encapsulated somebody losing touch with their former self, but all former country as well, and for love all in one film. It was just beautiful. That's, yeah, been a big influence of mine more recently. I'm a big fan of Korean directors though, so she's a Korean director. And my other favorite film is Parasite. I love the genre shift. That's something that I really aspire to. I love that blending of comedy and then suddenly thriller. I found it just so surprising and really multi-layered, and how its commentary on disparity of wealth, so intelligent, like in the writing, but also everything about it, like the cinematography as well, the directing, the character development. Yeah, that's a big inspiration of mine. I should revisit it actually. It's such a good film.
It is.
Other films I love, I love the Four trilogy by Richard Linklater. I think it's a masterclass in dialogue, absolute masterclass in dialogue. I recommend everyone to see it. And just how the events just slowly, gently unfold. I mean, it's not a big drama, like massively high stakes. Seemingly, there's not massively high stakes, but it's just about the beautiful relationship between these two people unfolding basically in real time, to be honest. It's a lot like more like a traditional play. So I think, like, yeah, maybe it's my background in theatre that has formed my love of that, those films, those three films. I think they're just beautiful.
Yeah, I agree. They're such great films, and you're making me want to revisit them again. I think I watched them the last time was not long after COVID, and I watched all three in a row, and I really felt like I'd lived with them and like I knew them really well because I'd seen them unfold like over different ages and sort of stages in their life. I think maybe my least favorite was the last one, but yeah, the first and the second are amazing. I'm wondering how do you navigate, you know, like any challenges or doubts that you have working in this industry that's sort of still involving in terms of inclusion and representation? Is there a sort of way that you overcome that, or you just kind of have to push through it? It's part of the process,
I
maybe.
mean, I think it's tricky for me as permanently a writer and actor. Those are the two job roles I have. It means that naturally I'm not on set as much as somebody like a cinematographer who just does film after film after film, you know. With writing, it's more, you know, legwork by yourself, and then you're thrust into the industry and you're dealing with people to face. But in terms of access, I do think, like, coming from a writing perspective, this is both in like film and I suppose in theatre as well. I do think that it is, yeah, it's limited, isn't it? It's a very, very difficult thing to get into and to sustain a career in. I think, sadly, you know, nepotism still play a massive part in it. I do think like that trickles down even to like more grassroots levels. I think it is who you know, and I think you should use that to your advantage and harness the connections you make, because ultimately, like when you're submitting scripts or submitting for jobs, you're up against so much skill and so much talent. There are a lot of people in the world now, and people have gone and done some amazing trainings and worked with some incredible people. So it's hard and it's difficult not to be kind of downtrodden about, and to it's easy to maybe lose faith in yourself. But I don't know, I guess I don't lose faith in yourself if you truly love it. I think like rejection is reflection on you all the time, or like if you do think you have areas of improvement, then work on those areas. But like if you can make things yourself, like make things happen yourself independently, I mean, that's something, a gift that a writer has, is that the idea generally will come from you. And for me, like I came up with Back of the Net, but then I harnessed a team, and then me and Clara built that together. But I had a lot of autonomy in that situation because I was doing it from a grassroots filmmaking level. I wasn't going into like a big production company where my voice may have been drowned out and stuff like that. But I do think actually, if you can manage to get some funding and you know, do some crowdfunding as well and do it yourself, it can really benefit you as an individual, grow your confidence, but also help you learn so much more about filmmaking. So that's the way I approached it. And like, you know, even though I've done that, people might think like, oh, doors probably opening left, right and center. And they have to a certain extent. Like I have a writing agent now and, you know, having meetings and stuff, but it still never happens overnight. And this whole chicken and egg situation with so many aspects of film, which is really frustrating. It's like, oh, I'm just waiting for things to get started and for funding to come and for things to get greenlit. But I think in terms of access, in terms of like people who are, you know, have disabilities, who are neurodivergent, I think that we're moving more towards a better direction with that and understanding of that. I think film in general, I mean, I haven't got too much experience on like super like, you know, big massive film sets. I don't have too much experience of, but I think there's still some work to be done there.
I mean, it's interesting how you say as well that, you know, if you're a cinematographer, sorry, or something, the sort of jobs come to you. But I suppose as a writer, it's like you've got to come up with the ideas, and that, you know, you don't know when inspiration will strike or when an idea will strike. Makes me think of I May Destroy You with Michaela Cole, and she's got the writer's block, and she, you know, she's trying to think of something to write. But yeah, I mean, that's, I guess, essentially where the challenge might come from is, you know, that pressure to think of an idea when you might not have one straight away. Because I guess, you know, you can't have ideas all the time unless you've got, I don't know, some people I suppose can write stories out of thin air all the time maybe, but I think for me anyway, it would be difficult to write stories on demand.
Yeah. I think I tried to write like at least like maybe once a week, like just in my morning pages, I'll write like a story or something, but they won't always be good. So I think you have to churn out a lot of shit a lot of time to get to the good stuff. Like have a little clean of your mind of all your ideas. And then eventually you'll get one that like, oh, that really rings true. And I really want to say that. And then you embark on the project of writing the script. Not every idea is going to be like the money shot.
Well, of course. I mean, I think that's just all part of the process, isn't it? And so many other screenwriters say that the only way to write something as good is by writing, and, you know, and until you come across that good thing. So as you say, you know, you might be a lot of rubbish until you, you know, get onto something that, you know, good and that you feel happy with. You kind of already touched on that already a little bit, but I was wondering what advice you would give to other emerging creatives like yourself who'd like to sort of break into film.
To write it, I would say show your work to people that you know, that you trust, as often as you can do. I mean, obviously don't just hound all of your mates all the time, but for me, Back of the Net went through a 3-draft process, maybe even 4 or 5 actually by the end. My play Trade, I think, went through like 8 drafts. I garnered a lot of external opinions on it. I didn't listen to all of them, and that's part of it. But, you know, doing off having opportunity to read out loud to friends, buying them a pint and just, can I just read the scene out loud to you and see what you think? I just think like making opportunities whereby you can share your work before you come to a shoot date or a production is essential to the process. And I've seen a lot of people fast track that part because they're just so desperate to get things on or get things made. And therefore, like the things are off or the script's not quite there. And I think just get your foundations right before you commit to production, because it will save you a lot of heartbreak or money. A lot of people try and fix scripts through editing or afterwards, which is like, that's just going to cost you way more time and money. So that's in terms of writing. And I think it's like getting the work on and producing it. Like if you truly believe in what you've written, if you really, truly believe in the work, and imparting that passion to others will manage to harness your team. You know, if you're passionate about this, you're passionate about the issues that it tackles, then it's most likely that other people are going to feel that passion too. It's just about harnessing that team and finding your people. And I do believe a lot in like lateral networking. Like I think a lot of people are waiting for a big director who's going to see them and make them. But like often it's just meeting other people who are like-minded like you at as many events as you can go to and getting advice and talking to them, working with them and understanding them and finding your people, basically, which is, yeah, it never ends and you're constantly meeting new people in this industry. But just, yeah, I mean, I met Clara, the director, literally only like 4 months before we even shot the film. Met her at a cafe through a friend and we just chatted for like an hour straight about film, about everything. And I told her about Back of the Net and I sent her the script and the rest was history. But if I'd gone to that cafe and randomly bumped into her, then that never would have happened. So I think just you have to be really ready and open to the potential connections you can make, which isn't always easy, but yeah, especially when you're like setting the fans down, I think it's really important to do that.
Definitely, yeah. And you never know when they'll be working on something and your name might pop into their head when they're thinking of a particular role or writer or something that they need. You know, it's always good to have that, to make that network, because to be in people's minds basically for their projects and vice versa. And lastly, so what's next for you? What are your upcoming projects? You've already mentioned a little bit already in the podcast, but yeah, is there any dates that you'd like to share for screenings, events?
Yeah, so I've got a few things coming up this, which I'm really excited about. So in terms of Back of the Net, we're screening at Lewis FC, which I'm excited about because Lewis FC are my local club. I grew up just down the road from the football club and went to school.
Oh, amazing.
Before. And they're the only football club in the world that pay their men and women's teams equally.
Oh, when it's a perfect place to show the film then.
Exactly. And they were massive advocates of the film. They really helped out, helped get it made. So, yeah, been amazing having that relationship with them. So that it's showing on their big screen and it will be on the evening of the Euro final. So it's going to be just like a little precursor to the final on the screen in their stadium. So that's,
oh, that'll be such a great atmosphere.
I know, it's really good. I'm really excited.
Summer football match and a film on top of that. You'll all be so excited.
I know. It's like a 3-in-1 ticket because it's their game, Liv versus Dulwich Hamlets, and then my film, then the Net, our film, and then the Euro final. So 3-in-1 ticket. It's going to be a great day. And so that's the 27th of July. And before that, actually, I'm hosting poetry set at Love Supreme. So this is a festival that I go to every year. I love it. My favorite. It's one of my favorite festivals. It's jazz and soul music, and it's in Glynde near Lewis, and I'm performing at the Bands and Voices stage, 5:45 p.m. doing poetry but also having some acts that combine poetry and music. And it's such a great festival, and I really recommend. Then I've got some more poetry gigs coming up in July. The first Monday in July I'm performing in London some poetry set. And then, yeah, in terms of like film, I'm at the moment gearing up to shoot my next short film, which is about somebody experiencing period poverty. Just a day in the life of somebody experiencing period poverty, a set on in a coastal town, and we are about to start the crowdfunder for that, and we're just sort of waiting to get going with it, really. But I'm excited to shoot that soon.
That sounds really interesting. I'm sure it's an issue that affects a lot more people than we realize. I mean, luckily I've never had that issue in my life, but I'm sure, like, you know, obviously there's a lot of people that it does happen to.
It's I've been working with a charity called Bloody Good Period, who are the leading period poverty charity in the UK. I really recommend following their work on Instagram because they are just so clued in with everything, like all of the statistics and how this affects people, and you know how many people are forced to choose between food and basic necessities like period products. So in search for that film, I spoke to their group of people who have first-hand experience of period poverty, and their refugees, former asylum seekers who didn't have adequate funds to have a period. So the main character in the story is a seeker who has to hide her period, and yeah, it's about getting out of that knotty dilemma.
I know a lot of schools now, you know, provide certain products for free and things like that, but I don't know how common that is. But of course, it's good that some people are putting that in place for people, like you say, that have to choose between food or sanitary products.
Yeah, so it's interesting because Scotland were the first country in the world to offer
Yes, they were actually.
period
Yeah, I remember
products for
that in
free.
the news last year, I think.
Yeah, I think it might have been 2 years ago now, but Wales still haven't followed suit, and it's still just as expensive as ever to have a period, if not more, because of cost of living crisis. But yeah, it's very rare that they're given for free. So yeah, and logistically getting that in place, it's just something that isn't really talked about very much. So yeah, something I feel very passionately about.
I've had such an amazing time chatting with you. You're so interesting, and you're with your different projects on Back of the Net and this other film that you're working on. Yeah, I've just loved speaking with you. It's been fascinating.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lucy. This has been a fantastic interview.
And that's it for today's episode of The Real Girls Club. A huge thank you to Ella for joining me and sharing the journey behind Back of the Net, from writing and casting to capturing those powerful moments on screen. If you want to check out more of Ella's work, head over to her website at elladormangaich.co.uk. I'll also link it in the show notes, as well as any other key dates mentioned in the podcast. If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to follow, rate and review the podcast. It really helps other listeners find us and supports the amazing women we feature. You can also follow at Real Girls Club on Instagram for updates, behind the scenes content and more stories from women shaping the world of cinema. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.